welcome to Base Camp for Men. I'm your host, Tony Rizak. This is a show that gives you insights and resources in how to live a more courageous life. We look to assist you on your hero's journey in any way that we can. Truth is our compass, humanity, our tribe. Welcome and let's get started. Hello, Base Campers. I hope you're all doing well. Well, with all sorts of things going on, including getting over to our new house in Central Washington and my beloved Seattle Mariners making the playoffs and scoring tickets. Go Mariners. I sort of ran out of runway to get you something useful by Tuesday. But do not fear, Base Campers. We have our trusty Base Camp Classics, where I take a real gem from our extensive back catalog and offer it to you again. And these are not random selections. I do my best to get you some of the best content and episodes that feel really relevant to what is going on in the world and might be really relevant with you personally. This one is from back in season 4 with James Rapson, titled Freeing Yourself from Niceness, and it is perfect for all you people pleasers out there, and I know I used to be one of you. A healthy dose of men's work cured me of this, and James and I talk all about it in this episode. Also, I want to write a short episode on the storm that we're all facing. It seems the rapidly changing landscape is creating all sorts of inner chaos and turmoil as we all prepare for our black belt test and how fast you can integrate new inputs in a changing reality. Are you following me? I think I can write a juicy fire starter in the next week or two. For the time being, enjoy this Base Camp Classic with James Rapson. Today's episode is brought to you by Stand Up Now Apparel. Stand Up Now has amazing designs centered on God, family, freedom, and patriotism. They use only the softest cotton in their designs and have gear for the whole family. There's something for everyone, Base Campers. I know you're going to love their products. Go support them at www.standupnowapparel.com and use the code BASECAMP to receive a 10% discount and free shipping. And now, on to our interview. Throughout my journey as a man and as a leader in the field of men's personal development, one particular approach has stayed with me over time: the use of male archetypes to help men on their hero's journey, whatever path that might be for each man. It was how I was trained as a young man, and I have had a love affair with these archetypes ever since. As the philosophical backbone of the Mankind Project's new warrior training, work in these concepts have continually provided a forward path with upward movement. And the use of archetypes has many dimensions, as the great philosopher and author Carl Jung helped us to understand. Archetypes can bring us into mythical and transcendent realms where the collective and personal intersect. And they also act as a diagnostic lens where we can read what is happening in humanity by looking in any direction: inward, outward, personal, or collective. Once your inner eye starts to focus on myth and archetypes, you start to see with new vision, a new vision that is full of magic and possibility as to where we are going and how you might properly play your role. Archetypes are great for enlarging the context, for making the conversation bigger. The larger the context for our unfoldment, the more excited I get. And with that in mind, let's go have a conversation about male archetypes with our friend, James Rapson. James Rapson has been an innovator in the field of personal and professional development for over 20 years. A former psychotherapist, his focus is now on training and coaching. He is an internationally published author and nationally recognized speaker and workshop leader, and he also co-authored the book Anxious to Please: 7 Revolutionary Practices for the Chronically Nice with longtime friend and collaborator Craig English. Here is my interview with James Rapson. Okay. I am here with James Rapson, coach, friend of the show, returning guest, James Rapson. James, welcome to Base Camp for Men. It's great to have you back on the show.
Thanks, Tony. It's really great to talk to you again.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was really excited rounding the corner of the new year, and I was thinking of you. I wanted to do a show about male archetypes. I've done a number of them. Some solo, some I've had other men on, and I just thought it would be a great time to check in with you around this. So I sent you some questions and you were game. So I was super excited about it. And you know, people, therapists and others, I know you're not a Jungian therapist, nor am I. But for me, I just find archetypes to be a really useful way to frame men's personal development. And I think, I think Jung was one of the most important thinkers of the past 100 years. And it starts to get into Joseph Campbell and myth and hero's journey and stuff when you start to go that way. And I'm really attracted to all that. And I guess my first question to you is like, what would be the value of working with archetypes? Like, how do you define them? What are they in your view? There's not really a right or wrong answer, but how are they useful, I guess, in men's personal development?
Well, I wonder if you have had the same experience as I have with men when you begin talking about archetypes or when they've been exposed and they come talk to you. If I were to put it into one word, it would be resonance. And even if they don't know yet that they're talking about archetypes, they see something with whether it's a warrior archetype, a king archetype, a hero archetype, but it resonates with something in them where they, and maybe within the confines and the confidentiality of that room with you, it's almost like a confession at first.
Yeah.
Like, they feel like I'd be embarrassed to tell my wife or my friend this, but I kind of resonate with that, you know, and quite often it's aspirational, I want to become that. I want to develop that in myself. I don't know. Did you relate to that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I remember when I first got in contact with the archetypes, it took a lot for me to realize, geez, I've got really flabby warrior energy. Because I'm around men that have really clear boundaries, that have no problem saying no to requests and all these different things. And it was like, whoa, I would never say I've got weak or warrior energy to any friend, but it became evident, wow, I've got some work to do. I got some work to do to reclaim that part of me because I see the gifts that it's bringing this man. And I want a little bit of that, you know what I mean? So, or I might need that in the coming chapters of my hero's journey. So, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And so we see it in others, and sometimes I guess I would say, particularly what we might see on the silver screen, with regard to especially warrior, is not necessarily the best example,
right.
Quite often of warrior, and yet it appeals to something within men,
right?
And they at the same time they don't necessarily have the best cultural examples. Many men don't have. So it sounds like when you talk about looking at men around you, showing, as you put it, the gifts of good boundaries.
Yeah,
and then resonate, and at some level going, that's good warrior energy. I need more of that. Good on you to recognize that and to say that's something that I need to develop in myself, and going from there. That's a terrific growth process.
Well, and you're talking about Hollywood, you see a lot of this, John Wick, just blasting through. It's just like, that's not really. And I think to your point, men, they it appeals to them because there's a lot of assertion of power, but it's such a shadow. It's not really clean energy at the point where you're killing everybody to get back at, this cabal that, killed your wife and your dog. It's like, it's not scaled, and it doesn't have real life application. You're not going to do that. But what are the real gifts of that archetype that aren't overblown by this Hollywood blockbuster? I don't know what your thoughts are on that. I think there's more lessons to be learned that aren't that bombastic or whatever, right? It's just like, it doesn't, what's the real gifts of that archetype that aren't about this kind of quick turn to violence and assertion of my anger, for example, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in an overarching sense, and we're talking about a handful, I think, today of archetypes, but in an overarching sense, I think what we're talking about in all of them is a trajectory that involves going from the immature expression to the mature expression. And in some ways, what that trajectory or that development involves has to do with how a person really navigates the process of either digesting or not digesting pain and suffering, and whether that becomes sorry for jumping around a little bit like this, but in a sense, whether it becomes a process like Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, now he's really specifically talking about the hero, but you could, in some ways, I'm not saying, carte blanche, apply it to all archetypes, but I'm saying that there is something similar in a journey process from the immature version of each of these to the mature version. So if we're talking about, when you're talking about John Wick, or you're talking about, one of the Vin Diesel things or what have you, all of our quote heroes or warriors right now in these things have to have some anti-hero in them.
Yep.
And I think that it's because it's in some ways we don't believe in the mature version.
Right.
Hollywood doesn't think that there is a truly mature version of the hero or the warrior. I shouldn't say it doesn't. I mean, there are modern examples. The one that everybody knows is Aragorn in Lord of the Rings.
Yep.
But there are others that you can point to. But it's what's really noteworthy about these less mature versions is they are cathecting the accomplished hero, but those heroes, what's noteworthy is those heroes don't really undergo a true transformation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is John Wick, he loses his wife and his dog and, right. And supposedly that's his transformation, but he's not really transformed by that. He just gets real mad.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he closes up as opposed to opening up.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It taps into that kind of shadow of like, I'm going to get back all the people that wronged me. So it's, he's operating out of a wound, but it's not
correct.
From a spiritual realization that, who do I really need to forgive here? It would make up for a boring movie if he sat on a cushion and realized, there's a lot of projection going on here.
But, right. That's right.
Yeah.
John Wick 5.
Yeah.
Insight.
Yeah. He sits on a Zabuton for 2 hours and then people boo the screen. But, I thought it'd be useful to go through, because in men's work, the way that I was trained and brought up, and the way that I coach actually too, is we work with five archetypes. We're gonna talk about four of them today, which is warrior, king, lover, magician. And I thought it would just be interesting to say, to sort of unpack, like, what are you seeing in the collective, on the macro level. How do you know if men are strong and clear in that archetype, or how, are they maybe not strong? Maybe they're showing a lot of shadow tendencies. And if there's any personal stuff for you and I, we could unpack that, because I have things to say. I happen to be pretty strong and clear in both warrior and magician, and my edge is really in lover and king. And I believe collectively there's a lot of work to be done in the king, which I'll speak about, and I'll save that one for last. But I thought it would be just good to look at each one. So starting, we've kind of already started to unpack warrior, but I guess I wanted to ask you, how do you know if a man is really clear in his warrior energy? We've talked about the collective and how Hollywood kind of pumps this, immature version of the warrior for everybody to see and say, this is warrior energy, but it's not. What is a mature version of warrior? And when you meet a man that maybe needs work or needs to be stronger in that archetype, what kind of behaviors, what do you see in the man? And I'll share a bit once I get your input.
Good.
Yeah.
Last time I was with you, we talked about my book, and the book involves seven practices, and the third practice is warrior practice. And I think it actually applies here. The way I defined warrior practice, or the warrior in that particular thing that we're striving to be, is someone who has a conscious personal ethic. In other words, they've actually worked to develop what is my personal ethic, not necessarily, what's something that I subscribe to, but actually they've worked it out. This is really, the poet David White said, looking back with firm eyes, saying, this is where I stand. So that they have a conscious personal ethic. that they have developed the capacity to hold intense emotions without reflexive action. In other words, I can feel something. I'm sorry. Did I cut you off?
No, you're good. Yeah.
Okay. That I can feel something powerful without having to act.
Mm-hmm.
And that when the time comes to act, that I am able to act and to recognize that moment and to act. So in that book, that's how I define the warrior. And that's not to say that's the ultimate definition, but that's kind of how I think about it.
That's great. I love that you flesh it out in a way, because that's the thing about archetypal work too, is it's different. The micro for the personal level and your views are always going to be different. How you see it, the lens is going to be a little different. And I love it, actually. I love what you said in your book about warrior practice. One of the ways that I kind of see it in the collective, the shadow of it, not just what the Hollywood thing that we talked about, where men might be quick to go to violence or anger rather than contain it, to your point, like to build a capacity for strong emotion and not reflexively lash out at your loved ones or the world. But I see where I see a flabby warrior collectively is all the men I know who are good men. Mm-hmm. They are so hypnotized by things like fantasy football. And to me, that speaks of a weak warrior energy, because the warrior puts first things first. You can't have warriors defending the kingdom who are talking about, whether Brett Favre was a better quarterback than Aaron Rodgers for 2 hours. That's not what the warrior does. The warrior is like we're putting that aside. And it's not to say you can't have diversions, but I see way too much sports talk, just stuff that doesn't really matter. I mean, things are really heightened right now in the world and inside of men. And I think, and it's not from a judging point of view, because I did that stuff. I was a sportsaholic for decades, and I did things like fantasy football, but it didn't pass the warrior test within myself. In other words, when I asked, is this really important? Is this really something that you want to spend your time on? The honest answer from the quadrant of the warrior was no, this does not matter at all. So why don't you set it aside? And that doesn't mean, I'm condemning, the immature expression of like, let me just screw around on the internet or screw around in sports and take up hours and hours of my time. If somebody wants to spend time with that, it would sort of shirk my responsibility to not point it out that, look, that's not really strong warrior energy.
Yeah, I don't hear it as condemnation. I hear it actually as a mature warrior.
Yeah.
Actually it's saying, where are you investing your energy?
Yeah.
And because there's a limited amount.
Yeah.
And one of the things that as I was thinking about and kind of jotting notes down in anticipation of our talk today, I thought back to something that I had learned many years ago with somebody else that I was reading, and he had said something really compelling to me that he was talking about the sadism and masochism in each of us, mm-hmm. not capital S, capital M, but small s, small m, that each of us have. Mm-hmm. And he said that as we grow, as we develop, that what we can do, it's not inevitable, but the sadism under the aegis of love can grow into discipline, and the masochism in each of us can grow into compassion. And what we actually really, really need, instead of running away from our own sadism, running away from our own masochism, it's not that we need to bury those things. It's actually that we need to sponsor them. Mm. We need to sponsor them into a more mature form. So when you're talking about having that willingness, whether it's in an individual setting, a group setting, professional coaching, what have you, but doing, and I do the same thing, Tony, of knowing the right moment to probably figuratively, but grab another guy by the lapel, mm-hmm. and say, listen, man, you're wasting some of the energy that really needs to go into being this warrior or being that king in your life or what have you. So I think that's what, I mean, am I wrong? I think that's what you're referring to.
Totally. I mean, I got put on the hot seat, you know, thankfully by men that cared a lot about my personal development, but the tone was like, what in the hell are you doing? What are you going to make your life about, Tony? Like it was pointed, but I'd waited my whole life to hear that from other men that cared. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, I'm noticing this. Am I wrong? I mean, what are you committed to here? And it was like, I needed that in a setting that was safe. And men are okay being called out when they know you've got their best interests, right? It's okay. And I had a mentor, a beautiful mentor, Jim Mitchell, who said, you know, men can handle feedback from mature men. And he said, it's the difference. The reason men reflexively move away from criticism is because when they were younger, they got criticized with shame and by men that did not know how to criticize cleanly. He goes, it's the difference between being cut with a clean blade and cut with a rusty blade. When a man is cut with sarcasm, it's a wound that doesn't heal. When you cut a man cleanly and it's in his own best interest, they can receive it. It stings a little because nobody likes to be called out in front of other men, but they can receive it and it heals and they grow from it because you're not out to demean them. You're out for their growth and nobody's ever called out this, you know, immature behavior, you know? And so when it's acting that way, I think men can really grow from it. And I know I did, and I was really appreciative to be, I don't want to say even say constructively criticized, but just called out of you're being immature here. You know that, right? And it's like, oh yeah, I am. Wow.
Yeah. You know, it's in that context, it becomes skillful surgery.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of skill in knowing how to do it, but the biggest part is actually having the maturity, and that having that maturity includes an element that you can't get any other way than by maturing, which is true humility.
Yes.
So there's true humility involved in having the boldness to apply your own laser beam and say, quit your squirming. This is where you're off.
Yep. Yep.
And when you do that with that person and that person has invited you into that place, they don't just not hate it. They love it.
Absolutely.
They feel the love in that.
Yep. Yep. How about the archetypal lover? What do you see in regards to men there? What's our edge collectively? Where are we expressing that archetype? Where are we not?
Yeah. I have such mixed emotions about where we are, you know, culturally with this. I think other cultures are better, the U.S. in particular. Mm-hmm. I see there are some ways in which we're kind of making some steps forward in terms of men learning how to do this. But my goodness, there's I would say I saw a term just the other day that I really liked. See if you even know what I mean in this term, petulant vulnerability.
I like that.
I just loved it when I read it, but I had the context of the full article. You were talking about this whole thing of men who are kind of going into this and being vulnerable, but it's this very whiny kind of, this is why I deserve special treatment and should be, you know, should be excused for my behavior. And, this is, you know, let's say it like it is. This is not love at all.
Right.
And, I see it popping up a lot in love relationships that enter my practice, whether it's couples or individuals, and I see the flip side of it where men are so armored against any kind of weakness. So I see a lot where men have manifest the sort of I don't really love the term love addiction because mm-hmm. I think there's a, you know, but I wouldn't want us to go deeply into, right. you know, what is addiction, but yep. where it looks like that. And I think we've all seen that, you know, so that also is not actual love.
One of the things that I notice in the collective, we have a lot of work to do actually in this archetype. The one thing I see in the collective is men, we've been so conditioned not to show that we, I think our care, our intense heartbreak for what we see happening in the world to women, children, to the systems that we live under that don't, where we don't, as a humanity, we don't thrive in a lot of the systems we see. And I think it's so heartbreaking that men don't even want to get over there in how much they care about what's going on. So I see a lot of armor, including myself. Like I have to check myself. Like I deeply, deeply care about our tribe. I deeply yes. care about our collective hero's journey and what is emerging in humanity. And I always have to make sure I'm wearing my heart on my sleeve to model it, because my tendency and my training is to not show that part because it feels so vulnerable. And it has, you know, we've been heartbroken, and to own that. And the other thing I noticed on a personal level is just how much I don't want to show my joy. Like I don't, I'll let my joy go to about a 6. Yeah. Nobody wants to see 10, you know, and it's like, yeah. and it's like, why not show it once? You know, it's just like this kind of tempered. And a lot of really good men I know, they're tempered across the board on their emotions, and including the joy and the love and the and just the exuberance of, like, you know, I think of Sam Keen, who said, you know, I know a lot of hardworking, responsible men. What I don't know enough of is men that are juicy and just vibrant and playful. And I think that's a real blind spot for men. I think we're naturally, as boys, we're naturally exuberant, playful. You know, it's just coming out. It's coming out of us, and then we grow into these responsible men who are like, "Well, that's for the kids." And it's like I really feel like we lose something when we leave our exuberant little boy behind. And I think that's firmly over in the lover category. And I try to indicate that to the men I work with, like, don't forget the little boy that really wants to play, that really wants that expression. And I have to remind myself, I have work to do, James, on this as an edge, because I can get a little too serious, a little too work, and not enough like, hey, maybe I need to, you know, I've got these notes that my son wrote me when he was little, and he said, he hands them to me. I keep them on my desk. In crayon, it says pass to play. And he says, Daddy, if you ever need a pass to play for the day and you don't want to do work, you can play this card to whoever.
Nice.
And so I keep it on my desk as just a reminder, because he presented those to me when he was a little guy. And just as a reminder that, look, this is a blind spot for men. And my young son reminded me, look, don't forget the little boy that has needs to play, to have fun, to be just self-expressed. So, yeah.
One of the things that I do, that's so beautiful. I love that story.
Yeah.
One of the things I do with guys on this mm-hmm. is I challenge the idea that their heart is broken.
Mm.
There's so many things that I'm remembering as we're talking today about why I do coaching instead of therapy. Mm-hmm. Like I'm a huge fan of psychotherapy. So I'm in no way saying anything bad about that. I love doing it for 20 years, but I can do so many things as a coach now that I couldn't do as a therapist. One of them was like what we were talking about before, like, you know, like kind of getting in a guy's face and saying, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, so, and this is another one. And like, I can kind of be a little, you know, when a guy is sitting, you know, being kind of knock-kneed and saying, well, I can't help it. You know, my heart is broken because she's, you know, I say, your heart's not broken.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they'll look at me and the tears will go away. And I say, your heart's not broken. It hurts.
Yeah.
That's different.
Yeah.
It's tender.
Yeah.
It hurts. There's nothing wrong, by the way, with you crying. Right. I don't mind that. That's fine. But you're fine. Your heart is like literally your heart is one of the most powerful muscles in your body. Mm-hmm. So is your emotional heart.
Yep.
It can take a beating.
Yeah.
And to start challenging them to begin to look at it differently. Like your emotional system, when you were a little kid, your psychological heart, your emotional psychology, it was very bruisable. Mm-hmm. You can get damaged. It's not anymore.
Right.
Begin viewing yourself not as tough, you know, like I'm going to clamp down. Not that.
Like it's a mature heart space more, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Imagine that you've got so much space in there and you've got so much, you know, so much range, you know, and, you know, I'm fully aware, having been more than 30 years in the biz of psychology, I'm fully aware that people have psychological injuries they're still working on and everything like that. But to tease apart and kind of help them to reimagine themselves having more emotional range and things aren't going to break. Mm-hmm. And like, okay, well, what if in my awkward early steps, I'm giddy and then people look at me like I'm weirdo. You know what? You're going to be okay.
Yeah, totally.
You know, maybe you start figuring out who in your world you can be like that and who can't handle it. Or maybe you start retraining them to expect you to be giddy sometimes.
Yep. Yep.
Makes sense.
Good. That's really good. I like that a lot, actually.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you think of the archetypal magician, how do you think of that? How do you conceptualize that? Or what comes up for you as you think, you know, healthy magician, you know, maybe shadow magician, what types of things come up or images or stories might come up for you as you look at that quadrant?
I'm going to be really interested to hear how you see magician and think of magician. I know what I read. It's different from how I usually, not different, but it's not entirely the way that I normally think about this, but this probably has to do with kind of what I do and how I think about it. T.S. Eliot had a great line long time ago when he was writing about another writer, a compliment. He said that this guy makes the strange familiar and the familiar strange.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the things that a magician full in his power does, when we were talking about mastery here, on behalf of others, makes the familiar strange. In other words, he takes things and then in a really skillful and on behalf of others, he kind of turns it on its ear.
Mm-hmm.
And the other person isn't, it's not just like confusion for confusion's sake, but confusion for insight's sake.
Yes.
And the other person, it's so one example of this would be the kind of trances that we do on behalf of others. Mm-hmm. You know, again, not necessarily just a hypnotic, you know, like I'm going to take you into a trance kind of thing, but where we just say, oh, it's not that, it's this. Mm-hmm. And the person kind of goes, you know, googly-eyed for a moment and just goes, I had never thought of it like that.
Yep.
To me, that's a magician thing.
I think I love that definition, and I've never heard it quite put that way, but it totally captures for me what it is. I think of it as the archetype of transformation, and the transformation can look a lot of different ways. Mystics for sure thrive over here because they're working with the divine, however you conceive the divine. A lot of times there's when I work with my spiritual teacher, I'm like, he's not only conveying eternal truths, he's reminding me of it. Like to your point, he's changing the narrative that I have of what's going on, almost magically. Like I'm like, well, of course I know that. Like, wow, I don't think anybody ever quite said it that way or I ever thought it that way, but he's having me contact the divine directly with these techniques that are very subtle. It's reminding me of something eternal in myself, the soul's journey or the spiritual path, spiritual enlightenment, all these different things. But it's also the quadrant of anybody that works with poetry, music, all the arts that remind us of transcendence. And then like on a lower scale, I don't want to say it's less than, but like you see it in technology. So a lot of the young guys, there's a magic to technology, certainly. Is it multidimensional? Does it connect you with the divine? Does it completely transform your narrative into something that has a touch of magic? If it doesn't, it's probably not considered high magician, right? It's like, and you know, there's just, I think there is some shadow there that I see in men that maybe have not wrestled with some of the existential questions. It doesn't take a lot to take on a meditation practice to see, like, what are all the mystics talking about? Why does Tony and James talk about it this way? Why does a spiritual teacher seem so resonant with something that's so deep inside me? It doesn't take a ton of work to uncover that, but I see a little bit of resistance in some men of like, oh, you know, that means I would do meditation on a daily basis, or some sort of contemplative practice might yield more ahas or spiritual, you know, insights. And the answer is yes, it would. If you do work over there, if you do the work the mystics do, you're going to know what the mystics know. And there's no way around it. Nobody just hands it to you. You have to say, I want that for myself. And so I would say everything you said, and then the things I said, I think there's a little bit, sometimes a shadow there where maybe a man wants a quick fix. Like, I want to know what James knows. It's like, okay, well then maybe ask him how he got to those realizations. Ask him about his spiritual practice. What does he studying with a teacher? That would be one way to start to uncover that. And you know, the short version, it's all in you if you're willing to do the work.
Well, there's a particular version of what you're describing, I think, and you tell me what you think, but that I see fairly often, which is when you've got somebody who is accustomed to being the smart person in the room, they will misuse that gift to dodge their emotional work.
Yep.
And they will use a little trick to disrupt things, or to, you know, kind of toss a distracting bone, you know, a different direction. And that is a magician kind of trick or energy.
Yep.
But it's misusing it, not even on behalf of themselves, much less anyone else.
Right. Right. Yeah. I see that a lot, actually. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. And it speaks to kind of there's some emotional, or there's a spiritual maturity, I think, that's in the mature magician. Mm-hmm. Somebody that has done a fair amount of work or been committed to a path of truth, I think, where the truth is not handed to you. The truth emerges out of the practice inside of you, and you surround yourself hopefully with people that are doing similar work, so the resonance lifts all the boats, so to speak. And I think that's readily available to anybody that wants it. That's the thing, is it's, you know, they used to disguise it in kind of mystery schools. That's why it's called magician. You know, there was adepts that, oh, we're only going to hand these secrets to transformation to a select group of, you know, the priesthood or the initiates. But we're way past that. It's really available, and the truth wants to be found about our divinity, our place in the universe. And it's right there. It's teed up for anybody that wants to step into it, I think. There's never been a better time to figure out, am I part immortal, so to speak? You know, I don't want to be, you know, getting into philosophy and religion, but there's never been a better time right now to discover what's really going on inside of you and inside of humanity.
Absolutely.
So, the last one I wanted to, I saved it for last, and I have a small story to tell. So, about the archetypal king. And for years, for 15 years, I led men's groups where we did rounds of, you know, lover, magician, warrior, and king. And, you know, we were handed processes that we did, and we developed certainly a lot of different processes and ways of expressing those four archetypes. But there was a funny thing. There would be lots of work and lots of expression in three of them, the lover, the warrior, and the magician. There was just countless creativity, a lot of different ways that men would go into these. And we would get to king, and it would be anemic. Like, we couldn't figure out what is the the proper expression of a mature king. And I had great men in there. I had men that were my mentors. And it stayed with me. It was just kind of this incomplete, you know, we would do stuff around gratitude and stuff around, you know, legacy and stuff, but it never felt like we were quite capturing it. And it existed as kind of an incomplete with me for a lot of years, where I was like, why is that not manifesting in these wisdom councils that I'm a part of? Why does this seem to be kind of elusive? And I'm seeing it right now that this is the edge. I think men are doing work in all three of the other archetypes. And I think there's a call right now to claim the archetypal king. And I think there's a shadow there. And I want to explain it a little bit and then hand it to you, in that we have, you know, the two shadows of the king are the tyrant and the weakling. And I think that we have been living under the shadow of a king that's not really ours. In other words, the tyrannical forces that have been running things, you know, you can make a really healthy case. There's a lot of sociopaths that make decisions on behalf of humanity. In other words, they really don't have feeling for you and I. They're not really acting on our best behalf. And as we, the people, the men, we've taken the other shadow. We've been the weakling, and we have said, well, we're not really running things. That's Henry Kissinger, or that's Bill Gates, or Tony Fauci, or, you know, Putin. Who, name your tyrant. We don't decide things. And so there's been this kind of victim weakling collective that we've all sort of been underneath. And so when I get together in good men's groups, when we go to claim healthy king, we don't really know what it is. We don't have access, because we're so used to, like, and I hear a couple different things. I hear men go, well, isn't the king, isn't that the power? You know, I want to have power and tell everybody what to do. I go, no, that's not what it is. That's a shadow of the king. That's the tyrant. That's not what we're trying to reclaim. And I started to touch on something here with sovereignty, because the king is another name for it. It's the sovereign, same for queen. It's sovereign. Are we reclaiming our sovereignty? And it seems to me there is a lot of work to be done here. And I'm trying to do it in my own way. Am I sovereign? Am I wearing a mask all over? I don't want to get all into COVID necessarily, but I see a lot of men giving up their sovereignty right now, saying, well, I have to do this. It's like, do you have to do that? Are you acting as a sovereign being, or are you following things that aren't laws because it's, you know, are you virtue signaling? You know, there's all these different things, and I'm seeing a lot of room for us to sort of reclaim what has been dormant, or what I've never seen in my lifetime, which is a healthy expression of a collective king that is part of our awakening, not part of any sort of lineage. We don't have a lineage that I can see. This is really reclaiming the edge of men. What are we going to do? What is best for humanity? Can we have those conversations? I would take just about any 10 men or women that care about humanity to make decisions over the people that make decisions right now, because I know that we would move things in a good way, way quicker than what we have now, which is this bureaucracy to protect, you know, people that don't really have, it's not to point fingers, but I don't think sociopaths should be calling the shots right now. And it's going to take a healthy sovereign to start to figure it out. And I know that's a lot to unpack on you, but I just thought maybe you could grab a couple of those pieces and start to unfold that a little bit. It's an ongoing conversation, and I'm trying to figure it out along with everybody else in the moment, because it's very dynamic.
Yeah. Well, no, thank you for all of that. It's really, really wonderful for you to kind of pull together, you know, that combination of your personal thoughts and the advantage of all of your, you know, your collected insight and professional observations, and all of that makes a tremendous amount of sense.
Which on ramp do you want to take there?
Yeah, no, that's it. That's exactly. I mean, you know, the political side is something you know, I probably would step away from it anyway.
Yeah.
In this context, you know, the podcast thing, but the main thing is that we don't have an apparent solution to it.
I know.
And one of the bravest things I think we can do is to admit something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the context of you start where you are. And that is way different than saying there's no hope or saying there's, you know, we have no chance, give up or anything like that. That is,
right.
You know, in me anyway, that is like completely different from that.
Yeah.
That's just saying this is where we are. You know, as you say, sociopaths are running the show. To what extent? Now, I feel an obligation to say, in a technical sense, we don't know how many of these people are diagnosably sociopathic or,
sure,
you know, some other personality disorder.
Yeah,
but it certainly seems like a much higher ratio than in the general public. Seems, yep, in some cases it might be a requirement for election.
Yeah,
you know, or selection by the powers that be behind them. You know, that you may have to have some of those traits in order to be desired by, you know, by the folks with the money.
Yeah.
But there's also something that when you get any kind of organization that gets above 100 people or so, the organization itself is going to take on somewhat sociopathic, or as I like to say, reptilian, mm-hmm, features.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in other words, it's going to be extraordinarily low on empathy and extraordinarily high on those kind of basic, you know, viewing everything else as, you know, is this something that I eat or something that eats me?
Yeah.
You know, it's going to have that kind of logic. And it doesn't matter whether that organization is, you know, Walmart or the Boy Scouts of America, or even, you know, a church organization or what have you. As soon as it gets into that kind of larger group organization, it's going to begin to take on those sorts of features and make, mm-hmm, decisions in that way. Mm-hmm. And we have these enormous, enormous, enormous political organizations that operate that way.
Mm-hmm,
so, mm-hmm. Even with regard to that, you know, saying nothing about the kind of the rampant corruption that we see happening, this is what's going on. So I'm not looking myself for a wise and loving and highly mature king to step forward right now and kind of solve that for me.
No, no.
That's my personal thing.
No.
However, that said, I want to look first to myself,
mm-hmm,
and say, in what way am I being responsive and responsible in developing the kingness that's in me? I am a father, I'm a grandfather, and king energy is very much in those roles.
Yes.
There is another circle, a sort of a loose community that's around me, and I have king-like responsibilities, mm-hmm, in that. And I always want to look for where are the places of mirroring and reflection that I get about, because I can't always rely on my own, my own mirroring of myself. So where do I get good feedback about how I'm doing in those respects? So I look at that.
I love
where
that. Go
ahead.
I love that. Cause it, one of the things that shows itself or manifests with healthy sovereign or king energy is, mm-hmm, this kind of, your values get carried over through the generations, right? Mm-hmm. You understand that what I'm leaving is my what my heart cared about, what this kind of resonance of the things, you know, that I love nature, that I love people, that is what gets carried into future generations. I think also what you were saying earlier about, you know, there's a lot of stuff right now. You see it in certain circles and tribes around the deep state and all that stuff, mm-hmm. the sociopaths. It's to identify it is enough. I don't think, and I've been down a ton of rabbit holes, but there isn't, ultimately you have to like set that aside and say, yes, of course, there's that going on, but you can't get stuck over there, right? Because I think to your point earlier, there isn't a king coming to save us. It's that we are raising, I think the vibration or the consciousness level of humanity is moving up day by day. I think we're realizing our unity. More and more people are starting to realize they're finding the higher ground, and the structures that we build will be built out of that consciousness. So in other words, like you said, I don't see a solution today, but as consciousness evolves, I think the solutions will come out of our collective, intention, prayers, brainstorming, creative activity, you know, divine intervention, all the things that are at our disposal as we continue to evolve as a species. I think that's what the king, the archetypal king, asserts itself through our collective awakening. And so we don't have to have the answers. We just have to have the right intention and not get down where we're blaming others or we're going down these things where we're all in shadow. We're projecting all of our, you know, all the stuff we project onto people that have power. And we haven't figured out, oh, it's us. We're the solution. We got to figure this out. Right. So,
absolutely. That phrase has become a cliche, but we are the ones that we have been waiting for.
Yeah.
I like what you're saying there.
So, well, James, thanks so much. Any last words of wisdom around King, anything we've covered? I love this conversation. I love everything that we've unpacked today. I think it's been a really interesting tour of the archetypes, but any last words that's kind of hanging out?
I guess what I would... Yeah, I do. Just in terms of the things to emphasize, principles overarching to emphasize.
Yeah.
In looking at this, I would say, each of these archetypes, in some ways, you could look in the same way you would look at a tool. So you look at the advanced form of a king or a magician or the lover or the any one of them mm-hmm. as being like highly desirable traits and really powerful, the warrior. And the images of those things are going to appeal to us in our primal sense, you know, as surely as much as a tool would. Mm-hmm. So in the same way that, someone, you know, whether you're talking about an adult or a kid, would look at a tool, anything from money to, you know, that cool gun sitting right there, or, you know, any kind of, you know, tool potentially someone would look at and go, ooh, what could I do with that? You know, begin to crave it. Yeah. So we shouldn't be alarmed, nor should we deny, if possible, that those things appeal to us. Mm-hmm. Instead, what we should begin to understand as quickly as possible is that craving exists in us, and we are going to have to temper it. Mm. So in the same way that craving of the development of that is an energy within us, and we want to ride that in the development of that, the development of the lover, the development of the warrior or the magician or the king, we also are going to need to use the development of our maturity and the development of true humility in the tempering of that, so that it becomes this full manifestation. So if we begin, if we're wondering, okay, where am I in my development? One of the things that you see is the true fruit coming out of this, not only on behalf of myself, but on behalf of others.
Yep.
Is it not just in my behavior, but also in my heart?
Yep.
And that's great. That gives you a good, uh, clue as to kind of where you are with that. Okay, that was my final thought.
That's great. I love it. Thank you so much for that. And James, thanks again for coming on and sharing your insight and your wisdom. It's always great to be in a conversation with you. We'll have to do this again as we unpack 2022 and see what arises. I think we'll be doing something later this year, I'm sure, as events unfold and we maybe come across things that we really want to chat about. But I really appreciate your friendship and I appreciate you coming on the show and sharing today.
Oh, likewise, Tony. It's always a joy to talk with you about this stuff. I love what you're doing.
Thank you, brother. I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. If working with male archetypes is interesting to you, I happen to emphasize this approach in my coaching practice. I currently have a life renewal program for men that helps you work with these archetypes plus the archetypal hero. I love working with this as a framework, and I can certainly help you create them as powerful tools for whatever transition or challenge you are facing. If you're interested and want to get started, or you're just curious as to what these sessions would be like, I offer the first session for free, no strings attached. It's a good way for you to see how you might benefit and if working with me is in alignment with you and where you want to go as a man. If you find value in our show and wish to show us some love, we are now making that very easy to do. You simply go to www.basecampformen.com and click on Donate Support Basecamp. You'll find an easy way to make either monthly donations for as little as $5 a month, or you can donate just once. We love the monthly donation and hope to build this up over the coming months, but any show of support is greatly appreciated, honestly. Thank you for your support and for helping to keep Basecamp as a resource on your hero's journey. That's our show for today. Thank you for listening. Men, good luck in all your endeavors and good luck on your hero's journey. This is Tony Rezac, and you're listening to Basecamp for Men.